From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. As students head back to college campuses across North Carolina, a report raises concerns about political bias in schools of education. You'll learn details. Lawmakers recently debated a proposal to allow North Carolinians to write off gambling losses when paying state income taxes. You'll hear the pros and cons. A key player in UNC Chapel Hill's paper classes scandal recently took her story to Capitol Hill. You'll hear the message she shared with federal lawmakers. And we'll examine the ongoing debate about the starting dates for public school calendars across North Carolina. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us, and she has the Carolina Journal headline.
In a little more than a year, North Carolina will again find itself in the national spotlight, the classic battleground state in the 2020 presidential election. Several of the Democratic primary candidates have already campaigned in our state, as has President Trump. A new poll by Harper Polling for the Civitas Institute gives us a snapshot of what would happen if the election were held today. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. He's here to look at the latest data. Rick, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Donna.
Let's talk first about the presidential race. President Trump, how does he match up with some of these key Democratic candidates?
Still in the lead, but within the margin of error of all of them. The closest one, interestingly enough, is Vice President Joe, former Vice President Joe Biden would come within one percentage point of defeating President Trump. It's 45% to 44%. Bernie Sanders is 2 points down, Elizabeth Warren 3, and Kamala Harris 6. Again, all within the margin of error, but still a very close race, as we have expected. And the more interesting thing to look for over time is not necessarily what the numbers are, because, you know, the election is not being held today. It's more than a year away, but how the trend lines go over time.
That's the interesting thing. We know that in 2016, the president won North Carolina. Many folks thought that he would lose North Carolina, but he pulled it out. But it wasn't a huge, huge victory. A number of states were won by just a few thousand votes. So at this point, anyway, it kind of feels like it's 2016 again.
Yeah, it really does. And it's interesting because the president will be certainly appearing here numerous times. It also feels like 2016 because you see in the two open congressional races that are going on right now in the 3rd District and the 9th District, the Republican candidates are tying themselves as closely as possible to President Trump, and their Democratic opponents also are tying the candidates as closely as possible to President Trump, but in a negative way. And so he is still the main issue in the 2020 campaign. There's no question about that. He's the dominant issue.
Now, we saw recently that the current lieutenant governor of North Carolina, Dan Forrest, officially kicked off his campaign to be the Republican nominee for governor. Now, presumably, Roy Cooper will officially say he wants to run for re-election and will be the nominee of his party. Interesting in this poll from Harper Polling that they looked at a group of people that could cross lines. They could be Donald Trump voters and also Roy Cooper voters.
Right. If they broke this down regionally, it would be interesting because one would think that those voters somewhere between 8.5% and 12.5% most likely are concentrated in the eastern part of North Carolina. These are the old yellow dog Democrats that would, on the state level, vote for a Democrat, even if it was a yellow dog. But when the presidential election comes along, they're open to voting for a Republican because they think that the National Democratic Party is too far left.
Is it an issue of job security and the president's focus on what he calls America First, and he's now implementing trade policies that are protectionist, all under the moniker of "I'm going to protect your jobs from being moved overseas"?
Yeah, I mean, free trade has never been a popular issue, a wildly popular issue at any time, but it certainly has not been a really popular issue in North Carolina. North Carolina has relied very heavily on the support of different trade protections and things like that to attempt to keep various industries healthy. And so from farming to manufacturing and things like that. What may be an interesting change in dynamic is the fact that the president's trade policies has led to some backlash in that some of our trading partners are responding by imposing tariffs of their own or banning the importation of U.S. products, and that seems to be affecting agriculture. But the farmers still, generally speaking, think that that's okay because the president seems to be fighting for them. That's the way they look at it. So it's an interesting viewpoint, and it will also be interesting to see if that actually holds over time, if the back and forth on trade has any kind of impact on whether or not the harvest is sold.
And there was also some money that was appropriated to give to farmers that were adversely affected by some of those trade policies. So that helps.
That's right. It helps some farmers. The question is more North Carolina's issue. Tobacco is not something that's covered by that. So for tobacco farmers, they get no help whatsoever from the federal government.
Rick, I think it's fascinating on this potential Trump-Cooper voter because, for example, if you're Governor Cooper and you're out campaigning, presumably you would be saying negative things about Donald Trump, about the Republican president, because you would want your fellow Democrat, whoever the nominee is, to be elected president. So how do you walk that line if you know that there's a pretty good percentage there? It's single digits, but that's enough to turn an election.
Right.
How do you not turn someone off?
That's going to be a tough one because, I mean, that's an issue that the governor faces in a lot of different areas. For instance, he says that he's against corporate tax breaks or tax cuts for corporations. At the same time, he's handing out corporate welfare to companies he likes all over the place. You can say, well, he is opposed to the budget that was passed by the GOP-led General Assembly because it doesn't do enough to give teachers raises and things like that. But he vetoed the budget, and the longer that budget stays inactive, the longer it's going to take those teacher pay raises that are in there from taking effect. So, I mean, it's a difficult position to always be in opposition of everything the Republicans do, or seemingly so, even though they do work on some issues. But that constantly, the old Senator No thing that the people used to say about Jesse
right.
Helms, Governor No may or may not be a very effective election strategy. And especially if Dan Forrest or whoever the Republican nominee eventually is, comes forward with a more positive agenda.
And in fact, we know that State Representative Holly Grange also seeking
yes.
the Republican Party's nomination for governor. So that certainly is not a lock for the lieutenant governor
right.
to end up being the nominee. You mentioned issues that the governor and the legislature are disagreeing on, perhaps working on some things as well. We know that the discussion over expanding Medicaid in North Carolina, something they are definitely not on the same page about.
Right.
That has been a key issue as to why we have had this big kerfuffle over a new state budget. This poll by Harper Polling actually asked North Carolinians, do you want to expand Medicaid? And very interesting as people learn more about what Medicaid would do.
Right. The general question, do you favor Medicaid expansion in North Carolina? It's 57% favorable, 27% unfavorable. But once the questioners start boring down a little bit into the details of what it would entail, for instance, the cost,
just a minor detail.
Right, right. Yeah. And that most of the people receiving Medicaid would be healthy working age adults without children, then the people who said they would be likely to support it goes down almost to even. So, I mean, it almost is a split question. Former Republican Party executive director Dallas Woodhouse put it this way. He said, are people for free or ice cream, free beer, and a 3-day work week? Yeah, there you are, until they find out what it costs them.
And Rick, we can't end this interview without talking about a fascinating result in this poll having to do with the question of socialism, which we are now hearing a lot about from candidates who espouse that kind of belief system. We now know that here in North Carolina, fewer people are opposing socialism than they did earlier in the year. What do you make of that?
Well, part of it, again, is the fact that candidates on the Democratic side are saying things, making socialism sound really nice. They're making people think that it's just simply the kind of generous welfare state that takes place in Europe, where they don't have to pay for their own defense largely and that type of thing, when they don't really say, no, this Venezuela and North Korea, that's socialism right there.
We've been talking with Rick Henderson, who is editor-in-chief. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are, and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly, but our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Schools of education throughout the University of North Carolina prepare many of the teachers that work with public school students across our state. That's why our next guest's latest research is so important and also disturbing. Jay Shallon is Director of Policy Analysis at the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, and the title of that research report is The Politicization of University Schools of Education, The Long March Through the Education Schools. Welcome back to the program, Jay.
Thanks, Mitch. Thanks for having me.
So you're looking at something that people thinking about education schools might not think about, and that is not how we're teaching our students or how we're teaching our teachers, but the politics involved. Why is this something that you wanted to look into?
Well, we've been aware of it for quite some time. I mean, one of the problems with education schools is they sort of fall between the cracks. A lot of people tend to analyze and look at and critique the actual K-12 education systems, and at the same time, they look at universities. But education schools are where the ideas from academia get kind of put through the meat grinder and developed into something that gets used in the K-12 system. And a lot of these ideas, as anybody familiar with academia would understand, are not always the best for the country.
And your report suggests that there's a lot of politics involved in these ideas and how they get filtered to these future teachers in our schools.
Without a doubt. There has long been a push to make our schools a vehicle to rechange society. And this goes back all the way to at least the early 1900s. The progressive era had all kinds of different schemes in which they were going to recreate America through the education system. And they weren't always overtly political. But what they did is they kind of scraped out all the traditional Americanism out of the school systems and leave it open for a much more radical group to come through. And this is not, on one hand, it's a very organic thing. On another thing, some people have directly targeted our education systems for politicization for a long time.
Now, you have a very thorough report. We're only going to barely scratch the surface. But what did you look into and what did you find?
Well, one thing I tried to do is I tried to look at the genesis of how it became politicized. It went through, as I said, the progressive era. Then it went through a process where, and it really didn't affect the schools initially, but the idea of cultural Marxism, in which you were no longer going to overtake the country through a revolution of the proletariat, and you were going to overtake it through the education system and popular culture. And one of the most dramatic processes that came out of that was the multicultural movement, in which many of the politicized methods are implemented in our schools.
In looking at the schools that you did for this research, is this an issue that has gotten worse over time?
It's much worse. I think anybody who is aware of what's going on today, just reading the daily newspapers, every once in a while you're going to see some outrageous incident of something like where in the Seattle school system they're starting to introduce, introducing children to transgenderism even as early as kindergarten. These kinds of things appear all the time. You know, they appear in one school district here, and something else appears in another. Fairly recently, in the last year, I think the Wake Counties looked at a system of changing the way they discipline students to have fewer suspensions, because there has been such a racial imbalance in the number of suspensions. And they claim that this is unfairly hurting the students who are punished because they're not in school. But to do anything else may unfairly hurt the better behaved students, because now they have disruptive students in the classroom more. So there's, there's the outrage of the week, and I expect it to get worse and worse and worse.
We are chatting with Jay Shallon. He is Director of Policy Analysis at the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal. The research report we're discussing is called The Politicization of University Schools of Education. Jay, I'm guessing that as you did this research, it didn't really surprise you, because you've been following this issue for a while. But were there any things that you found that you said, even I didn't know it was this bad?
No, but that's because I expected the worst. My main method, and which I've used in other areas as well, was to look at course syllabi for the books and articles that are assigned to education school students. And I pretty much found what I expected, that a large share of the books being used in education schools are heavily politicized. Not all. I looked at three different schools, the University of Michigan, the University of North Carolina, and the University of Wisconsin. And Michigan actually was much less politicized, at least overtly, than the other two were. But I looked at the syllabi and to discover, who the most frequently assigned authors are. And the single most is a woman named Gloria Ladson Billings, who is a critical race theorist. And the line I quote from her is from Marcus Garvey, the Back to Africa guy, and she said that education schools should be all race all the time. I might not have that quote exactly right, but something along those lines. So that's the single most assigned author across all three of these education schools.
Well, if that isn't disturbing enough in and of itself, in the brief amount of time that we have left, for folks who are not going to be able to read through the whole report and just want to get kind of the bottom line message, what is it that you hope people will get out of this research?
The one thing that changing the education schools is imperative, and if it can't be done, and I wonder if it can be done, then we have to start looking for ways around them. Because as children, you know, as the education system goes, so goes the next generation. And we're seeing things like very favorable attitudes towards socialism in the new generation. And this is, and other things. Many of the students have a negative look at the United States. And this is something that's being directly pushed in our schools of education and then down into the K-12 system.
Jay Shallon, he is Director of Policy Analysis at the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal. Jay, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mitch.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Should North Carolinians be able to write off gambling losses when they pay state income taxes? Republican State Representative Keith Kidwell thinks so. He explained why during a recent debate.
What I'm seeking to do with this amendment is to restore the tax deduction that was previously permitted in the state of North Carolina and is currently permitted by the federal government in relationship to gambling winnings and gambling losses. The gambling losses have always been permitted in the past to offset up to the extent of your gains. This is not based on professional gamblers. This is based on people who most likely have gone to a casino, put money into a slot machine, and I can give you a realistic example. I had a client who actually won about $300,000 over in Cherokee. But in order to win that $300,000, they put $280,000 into the machines to get there. Okay? State of North Carolina actually taxed that person on the entire $300,000. They were not allowed to offset the gains by the $280,000 they put in to win. Now, the problem with that, and I'm going to go to the North Carolina Constitution, only net income is taxed. Very basic math. You take the total winnings, you subtract the losses, you tax the difference.
Democratic Representative Greg Meyer opposed Kidwell's proposal.
The challenge with this is that it really breaks a fundamental tenet of how we do taxation. You know we have an income tax, but we only tax what you spend through the form of a sales tax. And we don't allow you to write off things that you spend money on, even if they're things that you perceive to be a loss. If you make money, you get taxed on it for your income, whether it's gambling earnings or money that you get from a paycheck, etc. But if we are going to start to write off expenses on things that you throw your money away, whether it be gambling or you buy a boat or you buy a car or you buy something else that ends up being a money trap, you don't get to write off all the losses on those things.
Opposition to Kidwell's plan came from the political right as well as the left. Republican Representative Larry Pittman explained why he planned to vote no.
With all due respect to Representative Kidwell, I think what he cited from the Constitution would refer to legitimate business or legitimate purchases and that sort of thing. I will never agree to consider any kind of gambling as legitimate. And so I think if you're so irresponsible as to throw your money away gambling and you take a loss on that, you should have known better before you did it, and that's your tough luck.
The State House voted down the proposed tax write-off for gambling losses. The idea could face a future study. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us, listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. One of the key figures in the UNC Chapel Hill paper classes scandal recently took her story to Capitol Hill. Mary Willingham was an academic tutor for UNC athletes. She complained publicly that the university wasn't helping those athletes get a real education. Now she's sharing her concerns with members of Congress.
I am a reading and learning specialist. I teach middle school students to read now. It's the joy of my life to be back teaching kids to read. When I went to the University of North Carolina as a learning specialist, I didn't expect to have to teach kids to read because those kids were a lot older. Even than the kids I teach now at middle school, kids should learn to read in first or second grade. But another civil rights issue in our country is we're not teaching all of our children in this country to read, and we're not teaching them to read continuing at each grade level. And somehow we're okay with that. But at the University of North Carolina, I had athletes who were so underprepared for the coursework. They were working on reading letters and sounds. They didn't know. They were just passed along. And we took them in the front door of the institution and promised them, in exchange for their talent, that we were going to provide them with a world-class education. Does it sound possible? It was impossible for me. Every year and every semester, more and more students would turn up in my office asking me if I could teach them because I'd been teaching one of their teammates. These students had real hopes and dreams for a better tomorrow. Their families were counting on them, not just to be athletes, professional athletes, which, of course, many of them believed they would be, but we know that that's not the case.
Willingham highlighted several UNC examples.
One of my students that comes to mind wanted to be a business major. She needed to learn to read first. She needed glasses first. That was a problem for the NCAA because it was something that they might not provide. How could that be? All she wanted to do was go back to her hometown, to her home county, and open up a YMCA someday when she was finished with her education. She couldn't even apply to our business school at Carolina because she would have needed a 3.0 GPA, and she was still learning to read. Another student, a basketball player, wanted to take Spanish. He was also learning to read, and more importantly, he was learning to write. He had never written a sentence before in his life. He wanted to take Spanish because he wanted to go back to California, where he knew a lot of people who did speak Spanish, and he wanted to be able to communicate with some of those friends that he made, and he wanted to be a social worker someday so that he could help students like himself who struggled to learn to read, and who his fifth grade teacher, by the way, told him that he would never learn to read, that he should just keep playing football and basketball, and that would be how he made his way in life. And finally, I had a football player who told me that he lived in a car for at least 7 years of his life. He couldn't read. He probably didn't go to school very much. But Carolina let him in the front door, and the NCAA in Carolina promised him something that we couldn't give him.
Willingham touted the struggling student athletes.
These kids, these young people, were persistent and resilient. They had grit. Like the kids that I work with today on the west side of Chicago who also want to play football and basketball. Real grit. We have such a great opportunity at our fingertips and we just let it slip away. And we all look the other way. And I couldn't do that anymore. The paper class system was created at Carolina and lasted for more than 2 decades. That's how we kept athletes like this eligible because they were superstars. And that's how we kept them on the hardwood floors and on the field on game day.
That's Mary Willingham, former academic advisor for UNC student athletes, speaking recently on Capitol Hill. She turned next to her book devoted to the high-profile academic and athletics scandal.
Jay Smith, my co-author, and I capture this system of academic and athletic eligibility, and we really take it back to someone who we all know very well, famous for basketball, Michael Jordan at Carolina. It was during the years just following him that this paper class system started. It started originally, like we all know, as a research paper, an independent study paper in the major that you're going to take. You maybe take one, but our athletes would be put in 3 and 4, and then eventually they weren't just the independent study numbers, those really high numbers in the colleges, in the different majors. They were any course in African American studies of all majors. Let's put all our black athletes in African American studies because that's what they want to study. There's a civil rights issue. There's so many. There's so many here to talk about. But these classes, these paper classes, they didn't require you to go to class. They didn't require you to really even do any work. You were just given a prompt, and it could be for any class in the core curriculum that you needed. Or it could be for your major if you're an African American studies major. But some students would have 11, 12, and I think the winner is 18 paper classes on his transcript, a basketball player.
Willingham reminded her audience that the scandal did not necessarily lead to any sweeping changes at UNC.
We had an investigator come in and actually, during my time, when the University of North Carolina was trying to hide all of this, it cost them about $19 million to try to hide this paper class system of eligibility. And of course, no one, not a single administrator or coach, was fired. And then the NCAA looked the other way. They couldn't figure out what to do. So to me, the whistleblowing, the writing, still teaching reading, for me, it's all about if we're going to promise students a real education, then we absolutely must deliver a real education in the very least. Pay the athletes, absolutely. But for me, education is what will break the cycle of poverty that a lot of these young players that I worked with came from. And guess what? They went right back to those situations. And the NCAA and the universities don't want us to talk about that. No research has been done on what happens to these players after they leave, with a degree or half without a degree.
What should UNC or other universities do to address the problem?
Doing some developmental or remedial work with athletes, which we heard just give a few extra years. So those students that I talked about that I believed deserve the kind of education that they wanted, the major that they wanted, if they had been able to stick around for a few more years, I think with some really good tutoring and really good help. So resources, we also talked about resources for students that they would be able to do it. Maybe it would take 7 years or 8 years, but look, most of you are really young in this room. You're going to live to be like 100. So what's the difference if college takes you 8 years? I mean, you've got lots of time. So I don't think that's a problem. And so that would be one example. And then the other example would be pushing back on admissions to say, you know, that you can't bring in students that are more than, what do we say, one standard deviation below the students that you're bringing in, right? So you have highly competitive schools like U of I and UNC, and then they lower that bar for the athletes, but there's no classes, not all athletes, but some of the athletes, of course, and then there's no classes that they're ready for because they're underprepared for that academic rigor. So if you push back on admissions, then my hope is now back in K-12 as a teacher that they would then, imagine this, higher education, schools of education pushing back on K-12. Don't send us kids who are so far off the mark.
That's Mary Willingham, the former academic tutor who played a key role in the recent academic and athletic scandal at UNC Chapel Hill. She discussed the scandal during a recent panel discussion on Capitol Hill. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, healthcare, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. The roads are about to get busier across the state as kids start back to school. But some might not realize that there's a reason that schools that operate on a traditional calendar, roughly 9 months on, 3 months off, all wait till the end of August to open. There's actually a law about this, a law that some school districts have decided to defy. Terry Stoops is the Vice President for Research. He's also the Director of Education Studies for the John Locke Foundation. He's been following this very, very closely and joins us now to talk about the new school year. Terry, welcome back.
Thank you.
What is the law about when schools can open?
Well, the law for schools is that they may not open before the Monday closest to August 26th. This has been something that's been implemented in North Carolina for some time, that there has been start date and end date that has been dictated by the state legislature. We're one of just a few states that has such a rigid calendar law. And so the fact that there are some school districts that are now taking measures to try to skirt that law isn't surprising at all.
Why in the world do we need a state law about when school would open?
Well, the argument is that we're a tourist state, and this will give predictability to the tourism industry for having summer employees. If school starts, in their mind, if school starts too early, then there will be some issues with them being able to obtain the labor necessary to work in the tourist industry in the summer. So they are the main opponents to any changes in the calendar law. They're the ones that are really talking to legislators about what they believe to be the economic damage that would occur if we change the calendar law so that districts would have the flexibility to choose their own start and end dates.
But wouldn't it simply make more sense that, let's say, a school district in the western part of the state might have particular needs of the community or norms or something like that, or even that the tourism industry would be different in the western part of the state versus, say, the central part of the state or the coast? Doesn't it just make more sense that people in their local communities could decide what works best?
Yeah, that's what I have been talking about for many years, and the members of a organization called Local. And this organization is made up of, get this, the John Locke Foundation, the North Carolina Association of Educators, as well as some other groups who all believe in calendar flexibility. Now, we all approach it for different reasons. Some of the groups on the left are concerned about summer learning loss. They think that if there was a calendar that constricted the summer months that students are off, then it'll address summer learning loss. For me, it's all about freedom and flexibility for locals. You know, you have, as you said, districts in the western part of the state that receive tremendous amounts of snow and would like to have more days built into their calendar to deal with those issues. And you have needs in the central part of the state and the eastern part of the state that vary as well. Certainly, there is nothing that would prevent those counties in the eastern part of the state of adopting sort of the calendar that we have right now if we gave them the flexibility to do so to help out the tourism industry. There would be no restrictions that I would believe should be put into place for these school districts to decide when school starts and when school ends.
This has been discussed for several years now, and we learned this year through the reporting of Ann Doss Helms that there are several pretty big school districts in one area of the state that we know for sure they've decided to just kind of throw up their hands and say, we don't care what this law says, we're just going to open.
Yeah, I'm not on board with that approach. I mean, the law is the law. Now, let me just mention that if they did want to change their start and end date, they could have went to the State Board of Education and asked for the State Board to give them permission to do this. The State Board gives permission to Wake County, for example, for their year-round calendar, and gives permission to other schools, especially those that are aligned with the community colleges, permission to change their schedule in order to open early so that the students who take classes both in the district and the community college have a similar schedule that they can follow. Unfortunately, I don't think the best way to do it is just to ignore the law and to not go to the state board and get permission. The law is annoying. I think that there is a tremendous amount of support for giving local flexibility for the school calendar, but that doesn't mean that the law should just be ignored. I think that probably the best way to do this is to go to the lawmakers, specifically in the Senate, and show them just how much of a desire there is across the state to make this change.
Do they have an appetite to do that, considering you mentioned the groups that are involved in this organization, Local? I mean, that spans the ideological and political spectrum right there. Does the North Carolina Senate, the leadership there, realize that there's all of this support for flexibility and that they're kind of the ones holding this up?
I think they do. And the reason why is because every year the members of the House file dozens of bills for school calendar flexibility, both for the entire state and for the districts that are that they represent. So they know that there's an appetite to do this. Their colleagues in the House are more than happy to try to get this type of legislation advanced in the General Assembly. But unfortunately, the tourism industry is very powerful, very well funded, and they their warnings about the economic damage that would occur, and I don't believe it would occur, scares a lot of members of the Senate and makes them concerned that there would be economic repercussions that might lead to issues with being elected in the next election or whatever their concerns may be with sort of the economics of the issue.
You mentioned year-round schools, so this is a head-scratcher for me. If there's so much concern about traditional school calendar schools not opening before August 26th, then why can't a year-round school even exist?
That's right. I mean, it is one of those mysteries. You know, the idea that we have a rigid school calendar law is based on a rather antiquated model of the school calendar. And it's not based on an agrarian calendar. I've got to make sure that people understand that. But it's based on a calendar that assumed that schools didn't have air conditioning. So having them sit in a schoolhouse during the summer was not really conducive to good learning. And that's right. It's not. But we don't live in that world anymore. And every school has air conditioning. So it doesn't make sense that we would not have school or not allow districts to start school in those summer months just because we want to stick to this sort of antiquated calendar. But, you know, giving districts the flexibility to create the kind of calendar that will help students learn, because in the end, this is all about student learning, or it should be all about student learning. Giving them the flexibility to provide a calendar that's innovative and that advances student learning, I think, is the key to giving them this kind of flexibility. And I hope that those in the Senate realize that when we give them, give districts the kind of flexibility they want in their calendar, it will help them raise achievement.
Terry, thank you.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the show this week. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.